Chapter 4. How do we use what is in the mind? Thinking, reasoning, and communicating. Behaving thoughtlessly, not stopping to think, being unreasonable or illogical, and being unable to express oneself are failings to which everyone is susceptible. The assumption is that when we do these things, we are failing. We should think before we act, be thoughtful and reasonable, and be able to put straightforward thoughts into words. The skills involved in thinking, reasoning, and communicating have produced literature, medicines, the microchip, and meals for the family, and without them we would be unable to function in the ways that we do. But the mind, as we have already seen, is a creative instrument, and not just a passive recipient of external information, which it faithfully records, stores, and analyzes, and it does not always operate according to the strict rules of logic. The investigations of psychologists show us that cognitive skills, such as thinking, reasoning, and communicating, are not merely products of rationality, and their value to us and the efficiency with which they work are not measured solely by the standards of rationality. As the emphasis in psychology has shifted away from the study of behavior and focused more on internal processes, the study of cognition has been approached from three angles. Cognitive psychologists have developed increasingly sophisticated, laboratory-based, experimental methods. Cognitive scientists have produced computer programs to create and test artificially intelligent machines. And neuropsychologists have studied cognitive processes in brain-damaged patients. In this chapter, we shall see that all three approaches have furthered our understanding of human cognition. In order to think, we must have something to think with. In chapters 2 and 3, it was argued that the raw material, what gets into the mind and what stays there subsequently, is not solely determined by the nature of objective reality, but also by the organization of our perceptual and attentional abilities, and by the processes involved in learning and remembering. If we can organize our perceptions so that they make sense, recall information when it is needed, and use it to think, reason, and communicate with, then we can make plans, have ideas, solve problems, imagine more or less fantastic possibilities, and tell others all about it. Psychologists are still finding out more about how we do these things. Thinking, the building blocks. Our understanding of concepts, the building blocks for thought that help us to organize our thinking and to respond appropriately to our experiences, comes from the work of philosophers and linguists as well as psychologists. Concepts are abstractions that simplify and summarize what we know. They contain general as well as specific information. For example, potatoes, carrots, and leeks are all vegetables that can be cooked and eaten. If we are told that celeriac is a vegetable, using this concept tells us, roughly, what to do with it. Concepts are formed through direct contact with objects and situations, and through contact with symbols or signs for those objects and situations, such as letters and words. I can learn about cassava by eating, growing, or reading about it. Using concepts allows us to represent what we know in symbols, to make one thing stand for another. So a T can represent a sound made in speech, and the sign T can also be used to represent something the same shape, a T-junction, a T-bar, or T-shirt. Some concepts are more useful to us in everyday life than others, potato rather than vegetable or chip. And these basic concepts are learned faster than those that are supposedly superordinate or subordinate to them. But even concrete concepts are surprisingly imprecise or fuzzy. Carrots are definitely vegetables, but tomatoes or pumpkins may not be. One theory proposes that we organize concepts around a prototype, or a set of characteristic features, and psychologists have found that the more an object differs from such a prototype, the harder it is to learn, remember, and recognize. Prototype theory has been useful in revealing some of the ways in which concrete concepts influence aspects of our thinking, but it accounts less well for our use of abstract concepts, such as talent, which may have no obvious prototype. We tend to suppose that our conscious mind is in control most of the time. We think about what we are doing, solve problems, and make deliberate choices, such as what to wear, eat, or say. We can also describe what we have done and reflect upon our activities, hopes, and fears. We suppose that, unlike the squirrel, which seeks unthinkingly for its hoard of nuts when woken by the warmth of spring, we consciously think about, control, and monitor our behavior, and that doing so makes us into thoughtful or rational beings. The research carried out by cognitive psychologists over the last 25 years has now shown that many different processes go on beneath the surface when we think, and has changed our assumptions about the conscious, logical nature of thinking. Thinking is not, for example, always a helpful thing to do. After prolonged practice, some activities that once demanded careful thought, like typing or driving a car, become automatic and can be carried out simultaneously with other activities, like having a conversation or planning a holiday. We can do them without thinking, and if you ask an expert typist where on the keyboard to find a particular letter, that person has to make a conscious effort and may mimic the relevant movements in order to answer your question. Subconscious mental activities can sometimes be brought into consciousness if necessary, but thinking consciously about activities that have become automatic, changing gear, running downstairs, is remarkably disruptive. Relegating them to the subconscious increases efficiency, allowing us to do them without thinking, even at the cost of occasional absent-mindedness, putting the frozen peas in the bread bin, or driving home and forgetting to make a planned detour to the post box on the way. It leaves spare thinking capacity for more important matters. The study of such cognitive failures shows that they increase with stress, fatigue, or confusion, and in this case can be reduced by stopping to think. Non-conscious mental activities demonstrably affect us, even though they remain outside awareness. Solutions to problems or creative ideas may pop into our heads, apparently without previous thought, when, for example, particular memories or knowledge are activated by cues of which we are unaware, enabling us to see new ways forward, how to negotiate a deal or secure a broken window. More surprisingly, we can also make a decision to act without being aware of doing so. Olympic sprinters can take off in less than 1/10 of a second before they can consciously perceive the sound of the starting gun, and changes in brain activity can be identified before people are aware of their intention to move. Even more dramatic, perhaps, are the discoveries about blind sight. After a surgical operation, a patient who was left partially blind claimed to be able to see nothing in a certain portion of his visual field. However, he was still able to tell whether a light presented to this part of his visual field was present or absent, and he could distinguish above chance level between moving and stationary objects. Although he thought he was guessing, his guesses reflected perception of which he remained unaware. Thus, thinking is not, psychologically speaking, synonymous with conscious deliberation. It may only be useful for us to become aware of thinking when having to make a difficult choice, whether to change jobs, when events happen that cannot be handled automatically, the car breaks down, leaving you stranded, or when unexpected feelings arise, someone makes you wildly angry. The concepts with which we think are constructions that do not have to be precise and fixed so much as effective when we are thinking, reasoning, and communicating. It is often supposed that these activities are most successful when they conform to rules that we have learned, such as those of logic and grammar. However, in practice, their success has many other determinants. Reasoning, using your head. Reasoning involves operating with the information we have in order to draw conclusions, solve problems, make judgments, and so on. Philosophers and logicians distinguish three types of reasoning, which are useful for solving different kinds of problems: deductive, inductive, and dialectical reasoning. Although these provide the basis for our rationality, they are demonstrably influenced by psychological as well as logical processes. Deductive reasoning follows formal rules, allowing us to draw conclusions which necessarily follow from the premises on which they are based. From the two premises, "If I am thinking, then I am consciously using my brain," and "I am thinking," we can validly draw the conclusion that "I am consciously using my brain." The conclusion may be false if either of the premises is false, but the reasoning remains correct. Psychologists studying deductive reasoning have found some typical errors, such as difficulty accepting unwelcome conclusions, that smoking causes cancer, or in changing valued beliefs, for example, that all mothers are benign. We are especially bad at thinking about what is not the case, as in this example of mistaken thinking. In a study from 1989, subjects were asked, "Is the following argument valid?" Premises: if it is raining, Fred gets wet. It is not raining. Conclusion: Fred does not get wet. Over 30% of subjects made errors. No valid conclusion can logically be drawn, as the premises do not indicate what happens to Fred if it does not rain. When a third premise is added, "If it is snowing, then Fred gets wet," the error rate decreases significantly. Errors using deductive reasoning often occur when the truth or falsity of the premises is unknown, and because our thinking is biased toward reinforcing our current beliefs and away from accepting information that contradicts them. Indeed, our thinking is subject to many illogical but useful biases. A friend of yours is sitting at home watching a football game. He tells you that if his team wins, he will go to the pub. His team loses, and you reasonably, though not logically, go to find him at home, even though he has told you nothing about where he will be in these circumstances. Deductive reasoning alone would not lead you to this conclusion, but your irrationality helps you meet up with your friend. Inductive reasoning is the kind of reasoning upon which science mostly depends. Researchers make many careful observations and then draw conclusions that they think are probably true, even though information yet to be discovered might show them to be false. It is commonly used in everyday life. "Mary criticized what I said and dismissed my arguments out of hand. Therefore, Mary is a critical person." Inductive reasoning allows us to come to conclusions that seem likely on the basis of our experience, and much of the time it works well. However, such probabilistic thinking can be wrong, not only because unusual or rare events occur, but for many other reasons. One of the main ones is that we seek out information that confirms our conclusions or suspicions when we are in doubt, rather than going through the more logical and informative process of looking for information that would show we were wrong. In the example above, for instance, that I had made many mistakes, rather than that Mary is always critical. As William James put it, a great many people think they are thinking when they are merely rearranging their prejudices. Another problem is that we look for what we expect, and our expectations are affected by our feelings. Reasoning is hard work and often places a heavy load on memory. In practice, we use many heuristics, or rules of thumb, to guide our thinking. Heuristics help us to solve complex problems. For example, the availability heuristic involves estimating the probability of a certain type of event on the basis of how easy it is to bring to mind relevant instances. The more readily available, the more likely it will seem to us to be. So the first thing I do when the printer does not work is to check whether I turned it on. My usual mistake springs readily to mind, and this simple action quickly solves the problem. So the heuristic brings with it problem-solving advantages that outweigh its disadvantages. The main disadvantage is that there are many determinants of availability, of what springs readily to mind, such as whether information has recently been thought about, is especially vivid, or is emotionally charged, and all of these factors may be logically irrelevant. So people who are frightened of flying tend to overestimate the likelihood of plane crashes, and do so more dramatically if they have recently heard about a crash. Dialectical reasoning is the ability to evaluate opposing points of view and to think critically so as to determine what is true or false, or to resolve differences. It refers to the ability to use a range of reasoning skills when thinking, rather than to a type of logic or scientific method. Psychological difficulties with dialectical reasoning arise, for example, when it is important for someone to be right or to have their beliefs accepted. Self-esteem can improve when people are right or on the winning side, and fall when they are wrong or on the losing side. Experience, feelings, and inclinations are amongst the many psychological factors that interfere with our ability to think with an open mind. In order to reason dialectically, we need to absorb and remember much complex information and to analyze issues dispassionately and critically. Our feelings and memories place measurable limits on our powers of reasoning. So does the packaging of the messages we receive. For example, presenting political information on TV in sound bites, shortened to be easily digestible and remembered, demonstrably interferes with critical thinking. Simplified ideas presented to us in ways likely to divert or entertain can be picked up even if watching TV mindlessly while doing something else. So, thinking can be influenced by the way in which information reaches us, and psychological factors contribute much to the complexities involved in thinking and reasoning. What we need now are good theories to explain and predict how human reasoning works, and why it is so hard to construct an adequate artificial simulation of it. One of the most promising theoretical possibilities is that we form mental models representing what we know, and the validity, or otherwise, of conclusions based on the premises we consider is assessed on the basis of those models. The processes of thinking and reasoning, therefore, depend upon the way in which we construct internal representations of concepts and other thinking tools such as images and propositions. Rather than standing or falling on the basis of their logicality, Such processes succeed when they help us to operate in the world, and fail when they do not. Another approach to understanding how we use what gets into the mind is, therefore, to think in terms of the problems we have to solve. In most areas of life, and much of the time, we are making judgments and decisions under conditions of uncertainty. We are thinking about what to do, or what will happen, without knowing the answers. Will it rain? Can I afford a holiday? Will the children want to go swimming? How am I doing at work? At our disposal, we have the ability to reason logically, and the ability to notice and avoid some of the most obvious sources of irrationality. We can behave as rational animals, and we can also switch into automatic modes and behave mindlessly without putting our lives at risk, driving on the motorway while having an interesting conversation. In order to solve problems, it helps to draw on internal representations, reasoning, and memory, and on all those reasonable, if not entirely rational, cognitive abilities that help us to make decisions under conditions of uncertainty. Problem solving has been studied by psychologists for about 100 years, and one of the topics in which they have been particularly interested is the way it is influenced by past experience, by information stored in memory. It sounds obvious that, in general, we solve problems more easily as we accumulate experience. This is known as the positive transfer effect, and it helps to explain why adults solve problems more easily than children, and experts solve them more easily than novices. Experts are better than novices at devising strategies for solving a chess problem, for instance. But both novices and experts benefit from a period of incubation, during which they are not, consciously, thinking about the problem at all. Once a strategy for solving a problem has been identified, it may take skill to apply the strategy, rescuing the curdled mayonnaise, and reasoning skills are needed to evaluate the progress being made. Experts are demonstrably better at recognizing patterns, retrieving relevant rules, and eliminating dead-end strategies. But experts can also fail to solve problems precisely because they use the same strategies and rules as they have used to solve previous problems. Developing a mental set prevents us having to reinvent the wheel each time we face a problem, but slows us up when faced with a new set of difficulties. It is remarkable how blind experts can become. Functional fixedness, or thinking about objects only in terms of their functions, is another kind of mental set that prevents problem solving. An envelope is something to put a letter into rather than a container for sugar when you are having a picnic. Solving the sugar problem requires thinking about envelopes in new and creative ways. Creativity has been measured in various ways. For example, by testing the degree to which people think divergently and explore ideas freely, generating many solutions, or convergently and follow a set of steps which appear to converge on one correct solution to a problem. The more uses they can think of for common objects such as a brick, the more divergent or creative they are said to be. Blinded by knowledge, mental set. In 1971, university students were presented with a problem which involved looking at a series of cards on which were written the letters A and B, and working out the correct sequence. For example, the letter on the left should be selected on the first card and the letter on the right on the second card. After several position sequence problems had been solved, the type of problem was changed so that selecting the letter A was always correct and the letter B was always incorrect. 80% of the students failed to solve this trivial problem within 100 trials, and none of those who had failed to solve the problem selected the correct solution from amongst 6 possibilities. We know that creativity is present at an early age, that young children can use familiar concepts in new and imaginative ways, and that environments that foster independent thinking in a safe way produce creative people. Creativity is not only important in the arts, but also in science, at home, especially in the kitchen, and in the office, and it may even confer adaptive advantages by fostering an inventiveness which can be needed in constantly changing conditions. Creativity requires flexibility of thinking and an ability to step over boundaries, and, surprisingly to some people, it is only weakly correlated with intelligence. Characteristics such as nonconformity, confidence, curiosity, and persistence are at least as important as intelligence in determining creativity. Communicating, getting the point across. Whenever we combine the representations we have in our head in new ways to make something new, to solve problems, or to express ourselves, we are being creative. And one of the most obvious ways in which we do this is in our use of language. But how are language and thought related? The theory of linguistic relativity suggests that language fosters habits of thinking and perception, and that different languages therefore point speakers toward different views of reality. Linguistic evidence is fascinating. It shows us, for instance, that Eskimos have many different descriptions for snow, that the Chinese have no common word for orgasm, and that the French language is rich in food metaphors. And we know that snow is important to Eskimos, that the Chinese are reticent about discussing sexual matters, and that the French are renowned for their cooking. We also know that we can learn each other's languages and can learn to perceive or understand the distinctions made in languages other than our own. But linguistic and cultural information alone does not prove that language influences thought. An experiment run in 1994 demonstrates how the combination of clear thinking and accurate observations helps to provide an answer to such questions. Asian children are consistently better at mathematics than English-speaking children, and in their languages, the names for numbers reflect a base 10 system. The label for 12 is 10-2, and so on. Some children from 3 Asian and 3 Western countries in their first year at school were asked to stack blue blocks, representing 10 units, and white blocks, representing 1 unit, into piles to show particular numbers. More Asian than Western children were able to make 2 correct constructions for each number. The Asian children used 2 blocks representing 10 units more than the Western children, and the Western children used the single unit blocks more than the Asian children. The conclusion? Language differences may influence mathematical skills. The evidence is strengthened by the finding that bilingual Asian American children also score more highly on mathematical tests than do those who speak only English. The evidence is accumulating to show that language can influence specific mental skills, but the jury is still out on the relationship between language and thought. Psychological as well as linguistic knowledge is needed to answer the question about whether language influences thinking, and scientifically watertight ways of investigating this question have not yet been devised. Work on the cognitive skills involved in thinking, reasoning, and communicating is still expanding. It covers the acquisition and development of these abilities, problems arising with them, interactions between them, and much else besides. Perhaps the point to emphasize is that in order to function well and adapt as we go, We need to achieve a balance between mindlessness and mindfulness, to know when to snap into action or stop and think. If we operated entirely on the basis of logic, like a robot or Mr. Spock, we would be unable to adapt flexibly to the complexities and uncertainties of the everyday world. Hence, there are still some respects in which our abilities appear superior to those of artificially intelligent machines, even though the machines may have larger memories and be able to test hypotheses faster than us. In particular, of course, we have feelings as well as thoughts, which may help us to understand why we do the things that we do.